Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. If you could travel back through time, where would you go? What would you like to experience? What would you like to find out? These are the kind of questions I'll be putting to guests in this new podcast for History Today magazine, Travels Through Time. My name is Peter Moore, and in each episode, I'm going to invite a special guest to become a time traveller for half an hour or so. There will be rules to their travels. They will not be allowed to interfere with the history or to participate directly in events. Instead, they are to be the silent witness, like Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, the cloaked figure in the corner, peering in, watching, eavesdropping if they like, but nothing more. They will choose their historical year and within that time travel to 3 different scenes. Now we have the ideal tour guide for this first foray into the past. Michael Palin is an actor, a writer, an explorer, a fish-slapping python, and a former president of the Royal Geographical Society. He has written many books of his travels from pole to pole or across the Himalayas, and in September he released his latest work, the Sunday Times best-selling Erebus, or The Story of a Ship. A few days ago, I met with Michael by the banks of the River Thames in London, deep in the basement of his publisher's Penguin Random House, in a darkened little room that was to become our very first time machine. Our destination was the 1840s, and I began by asking Michael what it was that enticed him towards this time.
A ship called Erebus, really, and a love of the sea and a love of exploration and a fondness for a particular period when enormous risks were taken by very small ships and very dedicated men to chart the world, really. It was a golden age of exploration, which is largely ignored. I mean, I read history at Oxford and I loved history at school. I never heard anything about Erebus or Sir James Clark Ross's expedition. I did know about Erebus's fate in the Arctic later, but the first extraordinary Antarctic journey is what enticed me to look at the story of the ship.
It might be good, actually, if you told us about Erebus. What was she like? Was she a graceful ship?
Erebus was quite a chunky ship. She was designed to take mortars, 10-inch and 13-inch mortars on her deck, which would lob shells at towns under siege from the sea. So it was all about dealing with the recoil from these very, very strong cannons. And so her deck would have been strengthened with diagonal timbers as well as horizontal. And also her bows would be very strong. She wasn't a big ship. She was 104 feet long. She was about 350 tons. So she was chunky, by all accounts, not a graceful ship, but people were fond of Erebus. People on board wrote lovingly of her attributes of sailing not fast, but being very solid. Someone said very solid below decks, if not when you were on deck.
So she rolled quite a lot.
She rolled, but she rolled well. Ships had to undergo a report when they came back, and at Chatham, when she returned, there was a ship's report which said that she rolled well.
Okay. And, yeah, I suppose rolling well's a subjective thing to the person who's on deck. It might not roll so well if you were getting accustomed. And of course, Erebus was not quite a loner. She was often in company with another ship as well.
She was in company on her 2 major voyages with Terror, which was another bomb ship like Erebus, but built slightly earlier. And Terror had seen action against the Americans in the War of 1812.
Right.
She'd lobbed shells at Baltimore.
So by the 1840s, Terror was a bit of a veteran. Terror was a bit younger, maybe.
Terror was certainly a veteran. She'd also seen the Arctic and the 1830s. Whereas Erebus actually, once built, went for a very short journey around the Mediterranean, sort of on patrol, really, nothing more than that. And after that, spent 13 years in ordinary, as they say, you know, virtually sort of waiting for a job.
I get the feeling that this meander around the Mediterranean was a nice prelude to something which came afterwards, which was a bit more stern, shall we say. Shall we go to your first scene? You have picked June the 1st, 1841. Do you want to tell us what was happening on that day?
Well, yes, I'm in Hobart in Tasmania. And in the small bay, later called Ross Cove, after the captain of Erebus, two ships were moored up very close to the bank. They had been lashed together and decorated with balloons, mirrors, lights, awnings, walkways with the palm fronds above them. And there was a big entertainment going on board these two ships, Erebus and Terra. Right. Erebus had been cleared for dancing and Terra for dining, and a large number of the society people of Hobart were coming on board to enjoy the hospitality of the Royal Navy, because the two ships wanted to thank the people of Hobart for being a haven to them as they came back.
So what were they celebrating? Antarctica. What was this great ball? Should we call it the Erebus Ball?
It was called the Erebus and Terra Ball.
Did invitations go out with that at the top of the invitations?
Yes, invitations went out. They were very keen on proper printed invitations. Okay. And the officers the captain. It was all properly organised. And the people of Hobart then, it was a sort of increasing, sort of swelling middle class who liked social events. Mm. But they hadn't seen anything quite like this before. In fact, one of the people who goes on board was an 18-year-old girl described as a lady of fashion in the papers, later said that this was the greatest ball they'd ever seen in Hobart. She danced with both the captains.
And how would she get on to the, how would she enter the ball for the Erebus from the shore? Would she have to go across some stepping stones or something?
Yes, well, you'd go to Government House, which was just about a sort of 100 yards or so up the hill. You'd go there and carriages would stop there, and then you'd walk down. And an area had been cleared, and then there was a walkway out to the two ships, probably about 50 or 60 yards. And this was a covered walkway, which had flowers and plants growing over it. And it was quite dark, so you went through this passage, and suddenly you came to the end, stepped on board HMS Erebus, which was the first ship you'd step on. The two captains were there. Everything was bright light, so you would go from the darkness into this sudden bright light. And they had the wonderful idea of using mirrors that they'd brought on board to give to natives, you know, in remote islands in exchange for sort of food or something like that. You'd give them a few mirrors. So all these mirrors, something like 700 mirrors, had been hung up and were reflecting the light. So it must have been a sparkling occasion.
Brilliant. So we're coming into Christmas party season, so this seems like the right time to be talking about the Erebus Ball. What were they celebrating, though? What were all these mirrors out for? What were they excited about?
They were celebrating the safe return of the two ships from their first Antarctic expedition, which had lasted about 4.5 months. They'd set out from Hobart, and they returned to Hobart, having discovered a volcano, Antarctica, having discovered that Antarctica was a continent, having discovered the extraordinary ice shelf, was sort of like 200 feet high, stretching for miles and miles, later known as the Ross Ice Shelf, and also gone further south than any other ship had gone in history. And this is a sailing ship with no power to turn around. If the wind was in the wrong direction, it was stuck in the ice. They'd come back, an enormously successful expedition. And they were also relieved, so they wanted to thank the people of Hobart.
So it sounds to me like a blend of fashion, almost like the old Regency fashion that we think of slightly earlier, and something of the Victorian exploration spirit, and I don't know, just transplanted into this little bay at the far end of the world for British people at least. Who would be there? And if you were among the crowd, who would you like to watch?
Well, they made a number of friends, the crew and the officers particularly, in Hobart. And there was a wonderful man called McCormick, who was a naturalist on board, or rather, he was actually a surgeon on board Erebus, who loved making friends. Whenever they stopped anywhere, he'd be the first to get off the ship. Usually he'd shoot a few birds because he loved wildlife. And
seems paradoxical.
It seems paradoxical. Yeah, exactly. But of course, at the time, you know, they couldn't photograph what they saw. These were strange and weird creatures. They wouldn't see them again, probably. So the best thing is just to get their hide or their fur or their skeleton or something. Anyway, so I'd love to see McCormick there, because he was he obviously loved company. He'd become very friendly with a family just outside Hobart. Also, I mean, I'd love to see Captain Ross. James Clark Ross was a rather sort of dashing man with a fine head of hair, and he was called the handsomest man in the Navy by Lady Jane Franklin. So I'd like to see what he was wearing and how he turned out. And then there was Francis Crozier, was the captain of HMS Terror, and he was rather a different sort of captain, rather more solid, bluff Northern Irishman. Never really got the recognition he deserved. He was a very good captain, a very good navigator. He was always second to somebody else. And I'd like to see how he would have dealt with the dancing. And
might have been second on the dance floor. That might have been.
Might have been second on the dance floor. First at the bar, maybe. I don't know. But it's nice that the two captains, you know, sort of shook hands with people as they came on board. Mm. And of course, they would have opened the dancing.
Because in one sense, it seems quite frivolous. But on another, what you're saying, it had quite a formal purpose. It was thanking people. It was to say thank you for their hospitality. Mm. And I suppose it's one of these exciting things that we think of Hobart being a gateway town. And for them, it was the gateway to the Antarctic, which was unknown at this time.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that of all the places they visited on this long voyage, Hobart was the most congenial in terms of climate, in terms of facilities, friends, social life. I know that some of the crew, man called William Cunningham, who was a Marine, left a very good diary. He was on HMS Terror, and he made very good friends with the military who were in a barracks in Hobart. And of course, being a Marine, he was with this sort of fellow military men, as it were. They became very friendly. There was a play put on after they returned from the Antarctic at the local theatre, which described the adventures the ships had been on. Apparently it wasn't very good. James Clark Ross didn't go, and McCormick went but hid behind a curtain as he watched it. So, but you know, there was a lot of links with Hobart. They'd come all the way from London, which had taken them, you know, over almost a year to get to Hobart. And they'd been in appalling storms on the Southern Ocean. They'd been to islands that were very inhospitable, but they had to go there to take scientific measurements and describe the flora and fauna and all that. But Hobart, they called it our southern home. That was how James Clark Ross referred to it.
Good. I think the one word which is echoing around my head is geniality. Well, this genial reception they had. Mm. And from that, I like contrast. Let's go to your second scene. Not too far away, or maybe a long way away. I'm not sure about distances, but we've gone to the 1st of January in 1842. Can you tell us where you are and what's happening?
The two ships, Erebus and Terror, had set out probably a month before on their second Antarctic voyage. And of course, they went in, you know, our winter, their summer, so it was December. But it was, unlike their first voyage, conditions were very much more difficult. The ice was much thicker, it was altogether much colder, and on New Year's Day, they found themselves absolutely stuck fast. Again, towards the ice shelf, further south than any other ships had ever been, apart from themselves. But the two ships were absolutely stuck. There were no channels ahead. There was no chance of any
movement. Was this a distressing situation?
I would think so. Hmm. I would think it was very distressing, because they had very little mobility. They just had the sails. If there was no wind, and there was no wind at that time, they were just stuck. But the interesting thing is that the attitude of the men on both the ships was to sort of make light of it and sort of celebrate their predicament on New Year's Day. It was going to be a new year, rather than, you know, sort of feel that they were stuck and this was it, and this was going to be the end of their voyage, and what were they going to do? They had a party, and they had a wonderful party on the ice, because the ice was so thick they could walk from one ship to another. So it was really like being, you know, in a harbour or something like that.
Just like one of those iconic frost fairs on the Thames. Or
yes.
Like that kind of thing.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting how you describe it as an almost ironic reaction. This is the British Navy of the 19th century, where they used to talk about shooting and being shot at with great good humour. You know, it's that kind of the opposite reaction to as you'd expect. So what was going on? What was happening?
Well, I think that it seemed largely led by the crew themselves. It wasn't officer-led, although Clark Ross approved of what was going on, but James Hooker, who was the assistant surgeon on Erebus and later the very famous botanist.
And friend of Charles Darwin, of course.
Friend of Charles Darwin. He went out with another sailor on board Erebus, and they went out into the ice and they carved an 8-foot woman in the ice, which they all thought was very jolly. And then they later carved a dance floor, and they carved tables, and they carved an ice sofa, and generally they prepared themselves for a New Year party. This is what they were going to do.
Wow.
And they created a pub using sort of some of the masts or spare masts, whatever they had, to put erect signs. And the pub was called the Pilgrims of the Ocean. And what is interesting is that when the party happened on New Year's Day, the idea was to make as much noise as possible. So there were a lot of trumpets and all that. They banged drums. They had pigs on board, and they put the pigs under their arms and squeezed them till the pigs squealed. Why? Why was this terrific cacophony going on in this utterly, utterly remote part of the world? Answer being, I think, because it was just reaction to the silence. Mm. And the silence down there must have been totally and completely, especially if there's no wind at all. The ships are stuck, there are no creaking timbers, there's no sound of water.
There's this real strong Gothic undertone here, isn't it? And of course, the 1840s, this is around the time that we're getting the Bronte novels coming out of Yorkshire. And this kind of great rise of the Gothic.
Yes.
Yeah. And then down there, it's this you kind of have in your head, I think, the whiteness of the snow, the clear skies, the silence. Mm.
You know, they must have been the only people on the sort of bottom tenth of the planet. I mean, huge, huge silence in this previously undiscovered area. And I think that's what must have driven them to make the noise and have the party and have as much fun as possible, just to say, look, we're here, we exist. We're not going to be intimidated. We're not going to be frozen up.
Yeah.
We are not put
and
off.
A very puzzling indeed their predicament. For the penguins watching on us. And Mr. Palin watching this at the far side of the world, would there be a nice to be a grin on your face as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd have joined in. I think that's just the most wonderful thing that you could have done in that extreme situation.
Yeah,
and it is extraordinary.
You can't imagine. It's almost like the British character in Extremis, isn't it? and the response to that is to build a pub, which is quite.
But also, I mean, it's also the fact that the hierarchy of the ships, which are very clear, you know, the captain at the top, able seaman at the bottom of the pile, but they all joined in. And the captain, James Clark Ross, almost literally let his hair down because he danced. They did the first dance on the ice with Crozier. And a witness said, Captain Crozier and Miss Ross opened the dancing. So Ross must have been in drag, actually was not anything new for him. He'd been in drag on the expedition 1831 in the Arctic.
Can I find a very strange comedic antecedent for you, underpants on your head? Is this James Clark Ross as a python 100 years before? You can imagine him there the rouge on his cheeks, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, there's music hall, definitely. But then it was python. I think the whole situation was very pythonic.
Really.
Yeah. The idea of carving a woman and creating a pub and a sofa. I think that's just lovely. So you could sort of sit down on the ice and relax.
Maybe we should send you all back down there to recreate this wonderful
pub. Yes,
that would be great. Okay, well, let's leave that because I think the cold winds are blowing through us and they're going to continue because we're going to go on to your third scene, which is a little bit later on. Time has passed. We've gone from the jovial early 1840s at one end of the world, and it's now the 22nd of April, 1848. Where are we? What's happening?
We are in the Arctic, almost saying the Canadian Arctic, but there was no Canada at the time, so we were in the Arctic islands off the coast of North America. Erebus and Terror had been stuck fast in the ice, not just for a New Year's Day, as it was before, and a few days afterwards, but for 1.5 years. They'd just been unable to move. And this, combined with the earlier delays, meant it was almost 3 years since they had left London to try and discover a passage, a way through the Northwest Passage, which had not yet been achieved. It had almost been achieved, but the last sort of 200 miles had not been covered. Things had gone wrong for them. The ships were stuck fast. And on this particular day, the decision was taken to abandon ship and try and make their way south to the North American mainland, hopefully find a Hudson's Bay post or somewhere where they could get food.
So we're looking at a big group of sailors leaving their ship, which is their home. So it's an incredibly emotionally powerful scene for them. Well, they realise they're in grave danger here. Which individuals would be involved in this?
Well, the leader of the expedition, Sir John Franklin, was one who would not have been involved because he had died 10 months earlier on board the ship. We know all this, and know all this from one note that was discovered called the Victory Point Note, discovered in a cairn later on by people 10 years later. Franklin had died. 9 of the officers and 15 of the men had died in the previous 10 months. So something was going wrong very fast. Whether there was scurvy on board ship, we don't know. But one feels that the people who left must have been weak and really unable to travel very far, which proved to be the case.
So would you be interested to see who was taking the decisions? And who would, what would your hunch be? Who do you think was marshalling the soldiers at this point?
My hunch is Fitzjames, who was the second in command of Erebus, I think was probably one of the leaders. He left the note. They knew it was his handwriting on the note. So
could you tell us a little bit about him? What kind of person was he?
Fitzjames, quite a jovial bloke. He was 31, 32, had no Arctic experience when he was chosen to be Franklin's deputy. Most of his experience had been out in the East as an artillery officer in the Opium Wars in China. But the men liked him, and he was a very good writer. He wrote very interesting sort of entries, diaries, letters, and he seemed to have a very good positive spirit. As they left England and were about to set out, he was the one who was saying, oh, we'll get through, it's all going to be fine. So I think his optimism would probably have kept him going. The other one, I think, who was probably leading them was Crozier.
Yeah, and he's the one that we met before, of course.
He was the one commanding terror during that New Year's Eve party, dancing with Captain Ross. Again, dogged, loyal, decent man, never given the sort of leadership of the expedition that some people felt he should have been given. But he probably was in the end. He would be one of the people who were leading the men south. We know that a lot of the what I know about this period is Inuit testimony, which of course was oral testimony, but they do describe the Inuit meeting a party of people, and the leader of the party sounds very much from their description like Crozier, a sort of middle-aged man, quite stocky, quite strong. And they met not long after they left the ship, and they talked to the Inuit and they exchanged some food with them. And that was it. They couldn't speak to each other because they didn't know each other's language. And this lifeline for these people was cut at that moment. The Inuit went off their way. And you know, the Inuit may well have been able to say, look, come with us, we will take you here. But because they couldn't communicate, this was one of these terrible moments where probably the last hope was dashed. Mm-hmm. And after that, they died, as we know, fairly soon.
Yeah, they didn't managed to travel very far at all, is that correct?
Well, some of them did get to the North American mainland, which is about 300 miles, but they all died, and they died at a place called Starvation Cove. Most of the others died on the way south. Some of the auxiliary boats on the ship had been towed along. They found dead bodies in them. But a lot of people think, and then again, Inuit testimony bears out the fact that some of them may have returned to the ships and taking command of ships again, because they were seen on board the ships in 1849, which is a year
after. And this is an incredible length of time after they've not just only left, but gone missing. So if you think how long a day or a month or a year is, then we're talking multiples of these, and people living in solitude with...
Very often in darkness for several months of the year. But I think the fact that some of them went back is probably very likely, and that they survived because there were just fewer of them. I don't know how many went back. As far as we can tell, maybe 15, 20 of them. So there would have been perhaps enough food to go around for them. But it's pretty certain that all the crew of both ships had all died by 1850, which was 5 years after they set out.
Wow. Still an extremely long period of time, but it strikes me as it is, geographically speaking, as well, this perfect mystery. You've got these clues which are hidden in cairns, or you have messages which are coming down through indigenous histories, and there's maybe enough to tantalize, but not enough to give you anything definitive. So we're working on, as you put it, a succession of hunches. I suppose that's the intriguing thing about you being there at this point. You'd probably be able to become the historical detective to see for yourself.
I think there are so many hypotheses, and so many people, very good scholars, have written about it. We'd all be there. That's where everyone wants to be, see what happened to those men.
So this in the story
is ship. It's a crucial
moment. It's
crucial
the day,
moment.
It's the moment, it's the scene. Yeah. And perhaps we might go so far as, or be so bold as to say, this is the one of the greatest mysteries in maritime history, or the history of exploration, of course.
Yeah.
Well, what better place to leave us suspended than that? I think my final point, you beautifully about this in the book, and you come to towards the end of your story, and as you describe it, you say, if Erebus was indeed named after the darkest depths of hell, it must have felt as if she had come home. That's quite a thought. And it's a story which really strikes me as having massive range, because you go from the excitement of the unknown, this lure of something which propels us all forward, you know, curiosity, to, you know, the tragedy of the second voyage. So there's light shades and there's dark. There's enormous landscapes, but small personal battles that people are fighting.
What I feel comes through very clearly is the optimism and the positive attitude of people at that time doing these amazingly difficult journeys. As they left Greenland, as I say, to go up to the Northwest Passage, we know from the last letters that it's going to be fine. We'll see you in the Pacific, you know, next summer and something like that. And the same with the Antarctic voyage, that worked out. Their optimism was rewarded with success in the Northwest Passage, I think because there was an element of sort of national pride as well involved with it, slightly more of a sort of imperial moment, I think, then that dashed their hopes very much.
And almost bookends in a way a long period of exploration history, because this is really the end for wooden sailing ships in the way they had been understood and used, because we have the great age of iron on the cusp of coming to be. We have one last question I'm going to put to you. If you could bring one memento back from your travels, you can reach your hand down and pick up one thing. Is there anything you'd like to bring?
I'd bring the pub sign, Pilgrims of the Ocean. Okay. I would just love to have that.
And that'd be
just
hanging in the Palin office.
Yes, up in my garden. On a cold day, I'd go and sit out there and carve an 8-foot woman. My garden's not that big for an 8-inch woman.
Well, we'd know where you live if there was a pub sign and an 8-foot woman sitting in the background. Michael Palin, it's been an absolute pleasure to travel through time with you. Thank you.
Well, that was me, Peter Moore, talking to Michael Palin deep in our Riverside time capsule the other day. His enthusiasm for the story of the Clark Ross and Franklin Polar Expeditions was clearly on display. And in his book Erebus, The Story of a Ship, he really does knit these contrasting stories together in an original and quite brilliant way. So it's a book that I would recommend wholeheartedly to anyone interested in the history of exploration. I'll be back with more travels in a fortnight, and our next episode is with the historian Dr. Diane Atkinson, who's going to take us to see some of the very best British suffragettes as they take on the establishment in the early 20th century. It's a brilliant, tense, and also somewhat surprising story, so please do listen out for that.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today, and on our website you'll find articles written by experts relating to Michael Palin's travels. You can read Philip Hatfield on the search for the Northwest Passage, or George Woodcock on the search for Franklin, or Sheila Rowbottom on the perils of sailors' diets. Links to all of these pieces can be found at historytoday.com/travels. And of course, there's many more articles on every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.